BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dalek Radio for Saturday the 4th of April. Well, last week in the studio we heard part one of a three-part interview with Mohammed El Haddad, the Bristolian who travelled all the way across the Rafah crossing to enter into Gaza in Palestine. He drove there, courtesy of the Viva Palestina crew, and we hear more from him. We also have Iqbal Tamimi. She's in the studio for an interview. She's a Bristol-based journalist. She's in exile from Palestine, and we hear about her interactions with local MPs. In a speech recorded in January, we hear this week from Labour MP Gerard Kaufman in the House of Commons, who comments on the Gaza crisis. As our part of our series on the history of organised crime by David Southwell, we move on to look at Elliot Ness, a name that may be familiar. He was one of Scotland Yard's most legendary crime fighters. There's the penultimate instalment of our repeat of Martin Bashir's famous 9-to-5 interview with Princess Diana, and Anthea Page does an interview with Philippa Carrick, the chief executive of the Tibetan Society in London, following her recent trip to Bristol for the showing of the film Fire Under Snow, which featured the Tibetan monk Palden Gyatso, who was imprisoned and tortured by the Chinese for 33 years. First of all, now, we go over to Tony Gosling for a news update.
Britain uses intelligence gained from torture because, although abhorrent, it can sometimes save lives, the government has said. British ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, who's now a blogger, resigned on this issue. In a report on human rights around the world, the Foreign Office said it's to evaluate all intelligence it receives, whatever the source, and that the intelligence is sometimes obtained from individuals in detention. The report, launched by David Miliband, the Foreign Secretary, said the provenance of such intelligence is often unclear. Partners rarely share details of their sources. The use of intelligence possibly derived through torture presents a very real dilemma, given our unreserved condemnation of torture and our efforts to eradicate it. Where there's intelligence that bears on a threat to life, we cannot reject it out of hand. But the government adds that such information would never be admissible in British courts. When we cooperate with countries whose practice raises questions about compliance with international legal obligations, we work to ensure our cooperation accords with our international and domestic obligations. Also, seek to develop and promote human rights in those countries. The Foreign Office runs a £35 million counter-terrorism programme overseas, according to the report, focused on countries which pose the greatest risk to Britain. It describes the use of torture in a section called Tensions and Challenges, but adds later, torture is regarded as one of the most abhorrent violations of human rights and human dignity. There are already too many people living on planet Earth, according to one of the most influential science advisers in the US government. Nina Fedorov told the BBC One Planet programme that humans had exceeded the Earth's limits of sustainability. Dr. Fedorov has been the science and technology advisor to the US Secretary of State since 2007, initially working with Condoleezza Rice. Under the new Obama administration, she now advises Hillary Clinton. We need to continue to decrease the growth rate of the global population. The planet can't support many more people, Dr. Fedorov has said. A National Medical Science Laureate, America's highest science award, a professor of molecular biology, believes that part of the better land management must include the use of genetically modified foods. We have 6.5 billion people on the planet, going rapidly towards 7. We're going to need a lot of inventiveness about how we use water and grow crops, she told the BBC.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'd like to welcome back to the studio Mohammed El Haddad, who came in last week and is here again to continue chatting about the Gaza convoy that was organised by Viva Palestina and the UK Arabic Society that left London and reached with about 500 people with lots of aid for the people of Gaza in Palestine. They took 35 days to get from London to Gaza. And last week we discussed what it was like driving through the EU, the press attention they got, or lack of it, crossing into Morocco and the trouble with crossing over borders, trying to get into capital cities to get aid and public and to engage with the public and not succeeding, sadly. We got about as far as Tunisia, so let's pick up from there. Well, thank you for coming in once again, Mohammed. How are you?
Not bad, I'm fine, thank you. And you?
Good. Now, in last week's show, we discussed your successful Gaza convoy trip, and we got up to sort of around Tunisia. You had not too many problems passing through the EU, and you had some problems trying to get through Morocco, and you were lucky to get into Algeria. Tell us about what Tunisia was like when you got to Tunisia.
In Tunisia, we were surrounded by the escorts and the army all the way along from the Algerian border to the Libyan border. They wanted to get rid of us ASAP, with no interaction with the public or, you know, public engagement at all. I remember, you know, when we crossed to Tunisian land, they wanted us to go to a town called Fas. That town is about 170 kilometers from the crossing points, and we were not able to do that. We decided to stay after 70 kilometers, where it is a small town called Gafsa. We wanted to go there, and they said, no, you cannot. You have to go to the second, you know, town. And, you know, the drivers were not able to cross that town. So we had a very, you know, long conversation with them. And by the end, we stood in the desert, and we decided to sleep over in the desert.
In the middle of the desert?
Yes.
In the middle of nowhere?
In the middle of nowhere. But they were aware.
Okay.
They were aware.
What was your accommodation generally? Where did you generally sleep?
In some cases, we were treated like a VIP people, mm-hmm. and particularly Morocco and Tunisia, Morocco and Algeria, but no public engagement. And we did not want that, because if those people decided to give us the money they spent on us to pass it over to you know, people in Gaza, we would be much grateful and appreciated. We don't want the accommodation for us. We want the food and the life for the people of Gaza. We were prepared to stay overnight in our vehicles. That's what we did in the EU. And also, we can sleep in a tent. We got our tents. We got our sleeping bags. We had a food for 3 days each vehicle. We were well prepared to stay for the whole journey in the deserts.
What was it like sleeping in the desert at night?
It's very nice. Yeah, we had a very good experience. We enjoyed the time. We enjoyed it. We really enjoyed it. We all were prepared. All the convoy were well prepared to stay over the night in the middle of the desert.
Is it very cold in the desert at night?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. But we had to switch the engine off on to make the bread warmer and eat it. So this is the type of people who, we are when we were in the middle of the desert. So we're trying to, you know, initiate things and, you know, create things to make things easy for us and life easy for us.
That was Mohammed El Haddad speaking. Thank you very much to him for coming in. And we hear part three of that interview next week. A speech recorded in January by the Labour MP Gerard Kaufman was a comment on the Gaza crisis, so let's hear that now.
Sir Gerald Kaufman.
Madam Deputy Speaker, I was brought up as an Orthodox Jew and a Zionist. On a shelf in our kitchen was a tin box of the Jewish National Fund, into which we put coins to help the pioneers building a Jewish presence in Palestine. I first went to Israel in 1961, and I've been there since more times than I can count. I had family in Israel, and I have friends in Israel. One of them fought in the wars of 1956, 1967, and 1973, and was wounded in two of them. The tie clip which I'm wearing is made from a campaign decoration awarded to him, which he presented to me. I've known most of the prime ministers of Israel, starting with the founding prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. Golda Meir was my friend. So was Yigal Alon, the deputy prime minister, who as a general won the Negev for Israel in the 1948 War of Independence. My parents came to Britain as refugees from Poland. Most of their families were subsequently murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. My grandmother was ill in bed when the Nazis came to her hometown of Staszów. A German soldier shot her dead in her bed. Madam Deputy Speaker, my grandmother did not die to provide cover for Israeli soldiers murdering Palestinian grandmothers in Gaza. The present Israeli government ruthlessly and cynically exploit the continuing guilt among Gentiles over the slaughter of Jews in the Holocaust as justification for their murder of Palestinians. The implication is that Jewish lives are precious, but the lives of Palestinians do not count. On Sky News a few days ago, the spokeswoman for the Israeli army, Major Leibovich, was asked about the Israeli killing of, at that time, 800 Palestinians. The total is now 1,000. She replied instantly, 500 of them were militants. That was the reply of a Nazi. I suppose that Jews fighting for their lives in the Warsaw ghetto could have been dismissed as militants. The Israeli Foreign Minister, Tzipi Livni, asserts that her government will have no dealings with Hamas because they're terrorists. Tzipi Livni's father was Eitan Livni, chief operations officer of the terrorist Irgun Svai Leumi, who organized the blowing up of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, in which 91 victims were killed, including 4 Jews. Israel was born out of Jewish terrorism. Jewish terrorists hanged 2 British sergeants and booby-trapped their corpses. Irgun, together with the terrorist Stern Gang, massacred 254 Palestinians in 1948 in the village of Deir Yassin. Today, the present Israeli government indicate that they will be willing, in circumstances acceptable to them, to negotiate with the Palestinian President Abbas of Fatah. It's too late for that, Madam Deputy Speaker. They could have negotiated with Fatah's previous leader, Yasser Arafat, who was a friend of mine. Instead, they besieged him in a bunker in Ramallah, where I visited him. It's because of the failings of Fatah since Arafat's death that Hamas won the election, the Palestinian election in 2006. Hamas is a deeply nasty organization, but it was democratically elected, and it is the only game in town. The boycotting of Hamas, including by our own government, has been a culpable error from which dreadful consequences have followed. The great Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eben, with whom I campaigned for peace on many platforms, said, "You make peace by talking to your enemies." However many Palestinians the Israelis murder in Gaza, they cannot solve this existential problem by military means. Whenever and however the fighting ends, there will still be 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza and 2.5 million more Palestinians in the West Bank, who are treated like dirt by the Israelis, with hundreds of roadblocks and with the ghastly denizens of the illegal Jewish settlements harassing them as well. The time will come, not so long from now, when they will outnumber the Jewish population in Israel. It's time for our government to make clear to the Israeli government that its conduct and policies are unacceptable, and to impose a total arms ban on Israel. It is time for peace, but real peace, not the solution by conquest, which is the Israelis' real goal, but which is impossible for them to achieve. They're not simply war criminals, they're fools.
Well, that was an extremely powerful speech given by Labour MP Gerard Kaufman in the House of Commons back in January, commenting on Israel. I'd like to welcome to the studio Iqbal Tamimi. Hello, good evening.
Hello.
You've been to the studio once before, and you're a Bristol-based journalist from Palestine in exile. So, but for people who haven't heard the previous show or don't know much about you, explain a little bit about what you're doing here in the UK and how you've wound up here.
I'm like many Palestinians who have been exiled. There is almost 5 million now of Palestinians who were forced to leave home, and they are all over the world. Israel's policies forced many people away from home, and other countries has to clear its mess. Mm-hmm. I ended up in Bristol, and as a journalist, I'm in contact with my colleagues here and with my local community as well. Mm-hmm. And I got lots of support from everybody. Thank God for that, yeah.
Now, we sat in the studio and all listened to Gerald Kaufman's speech. How did you feel listening to it? What was your reaction?
I feel grateful for him because if you are living in a democracy and politicians are decent with a human heart, they would tell the truth regardless of their faith or background. And I think he's not different from many of the MPs I have met. They have almost now the same view regarding what's happening in Palestine, especially after the attack on Gaza. I have met few MPs during the lobbying on the 11th of March. There was a national call for lobbying for the parliament, and it was this national call was brought by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Jews for Justice for Palestinians, the Palestinian Forum in Britain, Stop the War Coalition, British Muslim Initiative, and CND. And all of them were calling to end the blockade on Gaza, mm-hmm. suspend the EU-Israel trade agreement, bring Israeli war criminals to justice, end the arms trade with Israel, and uphold international law and end Israeli occupation. And I was grateful for our local MP because I've written to Roger Berry. Mm-hmm. First, and he was really busy, but his response was really encouraging.
Okay, he's the MP for Kingswood.
Yes, mm-hmm. I live in Fishponds, and he's our local MP. Okay. And he, I told him that I want to visit him during the lobbying in the House of Parliament, but unfortunately, he had lots of work that day, even though we went there with everybody lobbying from Bristol community. And after we came back, we were offered a day to meet him. I went to his surgery with two undergraduate students who studying journalism as well, and one British lobbyist for campaigning for Palestine. Mm. And I was really amazed with his knowledge, his depth knowledge of everything. He's been to Palestine. He visited different areas, including East Jerusalem, where there was evacuation of people to demolish their houses. And he's been to my hometown, to Hebron. Yeah. And I think he was accompanied by the Honorable Kaufman, who was treated very bad as well.
Okay.
And even he said soldiers who are very young in age, they asked him to which synagogue you go to in London and things like this. They were not respectful to the fact that these are representative of the British people and they are coming, you know, in a visit.
Yes. How did the lobbying go on the 11th of March?
It was perfect. I mean, there is quite a change in the whole understanding, and the MPs now in general have more knowledge and they are more sympathetic with what is happening in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing is that our own MP is the chair of Arms Control Committee in the Parliament, and he called to ban, to stop exporting arms to Israel. And he's also a member of the Labour Friends of Palestine.
Okay.
And we talked about many issues, and he's also an academic, so he's not just lobbying because he's trying to help his own local area.
Yeah.
He has many concerns about not just the international issue, about the institutions in Bristol and the arms and how this affects, you know, the local areas. And
Have you been in contact with many other of our local MPs? I mean, I've got a few names: Stephen Williams, Kerry McCarthy, Steve Webb, Dawn Primorolo, who's quite a high-profile Labour Member of Parliament. How have you got on trying to contact these people?
I did not. Because we are a big group. Mm-hmm. Each group will lobby their own MP because they have lots of issues to handle. I mean,
groups of you around Bristol.
Yes, okay. I mean, my MP, I've seen him twice, and on both times he was excellent. He also supported the local journalists here, who are my colleagues and NUJ members. Mm-hmm. So I was really grateful for his enthusiasm and for the respect that he gets by, you know, emailing you back and saying that I am on your side and I'm doing my best. It's refreshing, you know.
Okay. Do you hear any sort of positive words from any sort of front bencher or more high-profile government figures sort of supporting any of the points that you want, like ending the blockade on Gaza or suspending the EU-Israel trade agreement, stuff like that?
I think they are, at the moment, debating these things. It's not a very easy issue to talk about because, as you might know, that some of the parts that is used in the Israeli army or in the F-16s, some of their parts are made in Britain.
Yes.
And he said very clearly that we should convince the government to stop dealing with them because they usually say that there is every time they discuss every deal on its merit.
Yeah.
And they say that we don't, you know, it's like a condition that don't use it against civilians or against Palestinians. So this is nonsense because, you know, you can't...
How closely can you check? How closely can they possibly check?
They can't. Yes, exactly. This is why,
What is the situation in Gaza right now? What is the latest sort of...
The people are still trying to help, but it's still closed area. It's still under siege. Mm. I mean, you remember, you've just been talking about the people who've been from Bristol to Gaza, and it was very difficult for them to get in there. Mm. And even if they want to build now, you can't bring inside a building material. They just allowed some medical aid. But if you look down at this, an infrastructure which is totally, totally collapsed, you need lots of material to bring it in. And it's amazing that the international law could not do anything about such aggression.
Well, do you think whilst Israel is such good friends with America, we are any closer to peace?
I think so. We have great feelings of hope regarding the new president, mm-hmm. because, I mean, the things that we have heard from him up till now and the moves he made is encouraging. It's not just for Palestine. I think he's trying to reclaim that dignity that USA used to, you know, chant about, and freedoms, mm-hmm. and respecting human life. And we have to hang to that hope that he's going to change something. He started already talking about, you know, Afghanistan and other, you know, about international kind of policies regarding Pakistan, other areas, talking to Iran, talking to different parties. I hope we will be part of that plan.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming in, Iqbal, and I hope that we can come get you back in again over the coming weeks for an update and see what's going
on. Thank you very much.
Well, at the time of recording, Obama will have only just stepped off the plane into the UK, but I'm sure whatever he will say over the coming days in the run-up and during the G20 crisis will be examined in enormous depth. So let's hope perhaps he says something hopeful and promising about the situation.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
time for a little bit of lighter entertainment now. I'd like to introduce Tom Montgomery to the studio, otherwise known as Monty. To kind of very briefly put you on the spot, you're a singer-songwriter, you're a Bristolian through and through, or...?
Through and through, yes, indeed.
Oh, whereabouts do you live?
All the way, Redlands.
Do you sort of gig around town as well?
Yeah, all the time. Whenever I get the chance, really.
Okay.
Places like Halo, Folk House, the Old Duke, standard, really.
Good work. All right, I believe you are going to sing Estrangement again.
Strangers again.
Strangers again.
Yeah, it's a new song I've written, so looking forward to it.
Take it away.
Cool.
Breaking up with me, I drive you around the bend. You're breaking up with me this time. You say our relationship is built on excuses and cancellations all the time. And you can't love me like this anymore. Throwing me outside the door. Why do we have to be strangers again? Strangers again. Why do we have to be strangers again? Strangers again. Care what I say, 'cause I'm a chameleon. I'm just a people pleaser, you know. I'll only talk to you if I want something. You're just my favorite stepping stone. And you can't love me like this anymore. You're throwing me outside the door. Why do we have to be strangers again? Strangers again. Why do we have to be strangers again? Strangers again. As hard as I try, love, all I get is another disguise. Trying my best, love, but I'm out of focus in your eyes. And you can't love me like this anymore. You're throwing me outside the door. Why do we have to be strangers again? Strangers again. I don't want to be a stranger to you. A stranger to you, my love.
Okay, well, we've got Rachel Evanson about to play a track as well. But as a brief interlude, I thought perhaps seeing as today is Mr. Tony Gosling's birthday, and this is the musical moment of the show, perhaps we'd all like to sing him happy birthday, seeing as he provides so much material for our show.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
He's cowering in embarrassment.
Happy birthday, dear Tony. Happy birthday to you.
Woo! Red as a beetroot. Okay, hello, Rachel Evanson.
Hello.
You normally come along with the guitar, but this week you brought your sax.
Yes, and we're going to see how it goes.
Okay.
I'm just going to play. I'm going to try and play Feeling Good by any means.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Rachel Evanson. Any update on the Queens of Pretension? You're trying to form a band. How are you getting on?
I've got a couple of people, but I've got some uni work on at the moment, so it's kind of got on the back burner for a little bit.
Okay. How's the busking going?
Pretty well, on the bear pit, so every now and again, if you happen to pass by. Okay. And I'm also playing South Bank Arts Market this Saturday, and that's from 10 till 3.
Okay. So, yeah. Have you got any, Monty, have you got any gigs coming up?
Yeah, I do. I've got one on this Sunday, actually, in the afternoon, Seven Star, downtown near here. I haven't played there before, so it should be exciting. Got a half an hour slot. I think it's about 7 o'clock.
Okay.
So we should be good.
Cool, excellent.
Yeah, I've got MySpace.
Yeah.
It's up and running, but to be honest, it's only got one track on at the moment.
Okay.
I'm hoping to get some more recordings done. It's www.myspace.com/TLMonty.
T.L. Monty.
T.L. Monty. Yeah, that's the baby.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
We have a little tea and biscuits party going on the other side of the studio. There is much munching going on, so I don't know if that will be picked up on the microphones. It's time for part 6 out of 7 of our serialisation of Martin Bashir interviewing Princess Diana. It was shown on the BBC's Panorama in 1995, and it's never been repeated or heard of since. This week, Princess Diana now lives alone at Kensington Palace, and she expresses her hopes for William and Harry.
How would you describe your life now? You do live very much on your own, don't you?
Yes, I am. I don't mind that, actually. You know, people think that at the end of the day, a man is the only answer. Actually, a fulfilling job is better for me.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, any gentleman that's been past my door, we've instantly been put together in the media and all hell's broken loose. So that's been very tough on the male friends I've had and obviously from my point of view.
Does that mean that you feel that for the rest of your life you'll have to be on your own?
No, I'm not really on my own. I've got wonderful friends, I've got my boys, I've got my work. It's just by living in Kensington Palace, obviously it is a little bit isolating, but you know, maybe we all feel like that.
How do you feel about the way the press behaves towards you now?
I still to this day find the interest daunting. And phenomenal, because I actually don't like being the centre of attention. When I have my public duties, I understand when I get out of the car, I'm being photographed. But actually, it's now when I go out of my door, my front door, I'm being photographed. I never know where a lens is going to be. A normal day would be followed by 4 cars. A normal day would come back to my car and find 6 freelance photographers jumping around me. Some people would say, well, if you had a policeman, it'd make it easier. It doesn't at all. They've decided that I'm still a project after 15, 16 years that sells well, and they all shout at me, telling me that. Oh, come on, Di, look up. If you give us a picture, I can get my children to a better school. And, you know, you can laugh it off, but you get that the whole time. It's quite difficult.
Some people would say that in the early years of your marriage, you were partly responsible for encouraging the press interest. You mm-hmm. danced with people like Wayne Sleep. You seemed mm-hmm. to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You had a very good and warm relationship. Do you feel any responsibility for the way the press have behaved towards you?
I never encouraged the media. There was a relationship which worked before, but now I can't tolerate it because it's become abusive. And it's harassment. But I don't want to be seen to indulging in self-pity. I'm not. I understand they have a job to do. You could equate it to a soap opera, really. It goes on and on and on, and the story never changes. And each time one enjoys oneself, albeit it's in a different situation, you have to pay for it because people criticise, which comes with the patch, as I said previously. But I am a free spirit, unfortunately for some.
But here at Kensington Palace, are you isolated?
Well, I am by the nature of my situation, yes. But I don't feel sorry for myself in any way. I've got my work that I choose to do, and I got my boys, and I've got lots of opportunities coming up in the next year, visits abroad. I'm about to go to Argentina, which I'm very happy with, and hope very much to continue the good relationship that's now been adapted between the two countries. I hope I can be of help there.
What role do you see for yourself in the future?
I'd like to be an ambassador for this country. I'd like to represent this country abroad. As I have all this media interest, let's not just sit in this country and be battered by it. Let's take them, these people, out and to represent this country and the good qualities of it abroad. When I go abroad, we've got 60 to 90 photographers just from this country coming with me. So let's use it in a productive way to help this country.
You say you feel that your future is as some form of ambassador. Mm. But whose behest is that? On what grounds do you feel that you have the right to think of yourself as an ambassador?
I've been in a privileged position for 15 years, and I've got tremendous knowledge about people and how to communicate. I've learnt that. I've got it, and I want to use it. And when I look at people in public life, I'm not a political animal, but I think the biggest disease this world suffers from in this day and age is the disease of people feeling unloved. And I know that I can give love for a minute, for half an hour, for a day, for a month, but I can give, and I'm very happy to do that, and I want to do that.
Do you think that the British people are happy with you in your role?
I think the British people need someone in public life to give affection, to make them feel important, to support them, to give them light in their dark tunnels. I see it as a possibly unique role, and yes, I've had difficulties, as everybody has witnessed over the years, but let's now use the knowledge I've gathered to help other people in distress.
Do you think you can?
I know I can. I know I can, yeah.
Up until you came into this family, the monarchy seemed to enjoy an unquestioned position at the heart of British life. Do you feel that you're at all to blame for the fact that the survival of the monarchy is now a question that people are asking?
No, I don't feel blame. I mean, once or twice I've heard people say to me that, you know, Diana's out to destroy the monarchy, which has bewildered me, because why would I want to destroy something that is my children's future? I will fight for my children on any level, in order for them to be happy and have peace of mind and carry out their duties. But I think what concerns me most of all about how people discuss the monarchy is they become indifferent, and I think that is a problem, and I think that should be sorted out, yes.
When you say indifferent, what do you mean?
They don't care. People don't care anymore. They've been so force-fed with marital problems, whatever, whatever, whatever. They're fed up. I'm fed up of reading about it. I'm in it. So God knows what people out there must think.
Do you think the monarchy needs to adapt and to change in order to survive?
I understand that change is frightening for people, especially if there's nothing to go to. It's best to stay where you are. I understand that. But I do think that there are a few things that could change that would alleviate this doubt and sometimes complicated relationship between monarchy and public. I think they could walk hand in hand, as opposed to be so distant.
What are you doing to try and effect some kind of change?
Well, with William and Harry, for instance, I take them round homelessness projects. I've taken William and Harry to people dying of AIDS, albeit I told them it was cancer. I've taken the children to all sorts of areas where I'm not sure anyone of that age in this family has been before. And they have a knowledge. They may never use it, but the seed is there. And I hope it will grow, because knowledge is power.
What are you hoping that experience for your children, what impact that experience will have on your children?
I want them to have an understanding of people's emotions, people's insecurities, people's distress, and people's hopes and dreams.
That was part six of our seven-part serialisation of Martin Bashir interviewing Princess Diana. And that, the period that she was talking about, was around 1995. Next week, she concludes her vision for the British monarchy and talks about whether Charles or William should succeed Queen Elizabeth. No Jeff Sparks this week. He's festivaling it up. He's on out there drinking and watching bands. Hope you're having a good time, Jeff. But we have one last item before we go. Continuing Dialects' interest in the Free Tibet campaign, our reporter Anthea Page interviewed Philippa Carrick, chief executive of the Tibetan Society in London. Philippa Carrick visited Bristol for the showing of the film Fire Under the Snow, which featured the Tibetan monk Palden Gyatso, an absolutely remarkable story. He was imprisoned and tortured by the Chinese for 33 years, and we played a clip of him being interviewed on a previous show 1 or 2 weeks ago. That's very worth looking up. This is Philippa Carrick.
Carrick, I'm chief executive of the Tibet Society. We're based in London.
Can you tell us a bit about the society?
Well, the society was literally founded, I think it's the world's first Tibet support group. It was founded within weeks of the Dalai Lama coming out of Tibet. In fact, he left Tibet on the 17th of March and arrived in India on the 31st of March 1959. And I think following a letter in the Times in April, the Tibet Society was formed by a group of ex-diplomats and has been working on behalf of Tibetans ever since. So we're also commemorating 50 years of existence.
And what effect do you think that's had on the situation in Tibet?
Well, sadly, over the years, I think some of the work that we've done, because we were instrumental and helped Tibetans put their case for the United Nations resolutions back in the early 60s, and I think we've been a force for good in some immediate stuff through the years. But unfortunately, the Tibet situation is really no nearer being resolved now than it was 50 years ago. And currently, Tibet is effectively under de facto martial law and is in complete shutdown, and nothing, no news, nothing is getting out. China has got such an enforced grip and has been putting a huge amount of military build-up on the streets. And it's a grim situation there.
What about human rights? Do you work with Amnesty?
We don't have any formal connection with Amnesty. I mean, obviously, Amnesty keep us informed if there's particular prisoners of conscience, as Palden Gyatso was a prisoner of conscience for Amnesty some years ago, obviously. But we don't have any formal links, but we sort of keep in the loop, and we sometimes have roundtables with Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch.
So people listening to the programme today, what can they do to help the people of Tibet? They might feel very strongly about it, but feel that there's nothing they can do. But you think there is?
Yes, I think there is. I think, you know, we're lucky enough to be living in a democracy, and we're lucky enough to have MPs who work for us. And we must use that and get our MPs to actually work for us and therefore work for Tibet, and really sort of begin to sort of lobby our MPs to then make sure that our MPs are lobbying the government and the Foreign Office and generally, you know, being insistent that something really must be done and Tibet does not drop off the radar, but in fact that the government stands by its reaffirmation that it supports the Dalai Lama and supports greater autonomy for Tibet and supports the Dalai Lama's wish for greater autonomy for Tibet, and actually takes some positive action. And that trickles back down to all of us being able to make these points and to keep in contact and build a relationship with your MP, you know, form constituency groups of like-minded individuals and go and meet your MP, you know, once every month, once every 2 months, and really sort of keep them in the loop as far as Tibet is concerned.
Can they write letters to the MP?
Oh, yes. Everybody, indeed, anybody, if you're ever in London, you can actually go into Westminster and just ask to see your MP. It's a democratic right that we have. It's one that's not often taken up, but if you feel very strongly about an issue, you know, it's great to go and see your MP in the House of Commons in London. And we had this big mass lobby on the 10th of March, which was the 50th commemoration of the Tibetan People's Uprising. And encouragingly, it was run by a coalition of Tibet support, UK Tibet support groups, and one of these was the Tibetan community in Britain. And they had done a fantastic job in motivating Tibetans who are now living in Britain to go and take up this democratic right and go and visit their MPs of wherever they were living and actually advocate their own cause directly to the MPs. So at the current time, there is a very high awareness of Tibet, I think, amongst many MPs, because the central lobby was absolutely chaotic, full of Tibetans, full of UK and Tibet supporters, all making the point. But I think it's very encouraging that Tibetans in exile are actually taking ownership of their own plight and actually advocating in their own words. And I think nothing is more powerful for a cause than if the people themselves actually can speak out about it. And so it is very encouraging. And it doesn't matter, Tibetans came from Bristol, they came from Bournemouth, they came from Blackpool.
Was this the march? Can you tell us what happened on the march? How many people turned out?
The march was on the 7th of March, and that I think it was between about 600 and 800 people turned out for the march, and we ended that with a big rally in Trafalgar Square. And Paldin Gyatso spoke at the rally, as did Norman Baker MP, and also a young Chinese journalist who actually was at Tiananmen Square spoke out very strongly, and indeed it sort of read out an apology for, about the issue of Tibet. So it was a very moving and a very strong occasion, the march on the 7th, and then for that to be followed by the mass lobby on the 10th of March was tremendous. So I think London really got to know about the issue of Tibet.
But do you have to keep up the pressure now?
I think yes. I think this is it. We all need to keep up the pressure. That's why it's good to engage with MPs and also actually local radio and local television. If ever something does happen and you know somebody who knows feels strongly about Tibet, or there's a local Tibetan who can speak out on radio or TV locally, it's always a good story, and it does actually engage more grassroots and awareness of Tibet and more people who can then sort of lobby their MPs, indeed your MEPs. We mustn't forget the European Parliament and the European Union on this. So there are plenty of ways that you can make your voice heard. And another thing to remember is that images do get back into Tibet, and also and Tibetans inside Tibet are aware that there is worldwide concern. So things like, flying a Tibetan flag in your garden and sending photographs in to places like Tibet Society that gets posted up on the internet. Again, it's all motivating for Tibetans actually inside Tibet. And I think one mustn't forget, you can lobby your MPs, but it's also good for Tibetans inside Tibet to know that there really is genuine worldwide concern about their plight.
Do you have a website so people can log on and see what's happening?
Yes, sure. We've got a website. It's www.tibetsociety.com. And we try and keep it updated as much as possible. But we do always have things that can happen. You can always email us at info@tibetsociety.com if you want further details or any sort of information packs to be sent out, any lobby cards that you can then send on to your MP. We'd be delighted to send you everything.
So if people were listening to this and they thought, yes, I'm going to display a Tibetan flag in my window, where would they get them from?
You can buy Tibetan flags from us if you email us, or I think we've got it through a website called enlightenedgifts.org, which actually has quite a lot of Tibetan badges and Tibetan car stickers and things like that, but it also has Tibetan flags. And I think it is a very motivating way. There is a worldwide sort of movement to try and get as many people, flying the flag. And if anybody does fly a flag or sees a Tibetan flag in some place, I think there's a pub somewhere actually in the Bristol area that a friend of mine said that he suddenly spotted a Tibetan flag flying outside it. So do take a picture and send it in to us, and we'll post it up on a website.
So the message is to everybody, keep the flag flying at
Absolutely.
All costs.
Raise the Tibetan flag and show solidarity with the Tibetan people inside Tibet, for sure.
That was Anthea Page talking to Philippa Carrick, the chief executive of the Tibetan Society in London. And as a point of general interest, I looked up an article about the Tibetan flag and what all the various parts of it mean. And it was very interesting because I didn't know that. It's always worth looking up these sorts of things. And lastly, as part of our series on the history of organised crime by David Southwell, who we hope to interview in coming weeks, we move on to look at Elliot Ness, who's featured, of course, in the film Untouchables, played by Kevin Costner. He, that famous name, who was he? He was one of Scotland Yard's legendary crime fighters. Frighters?
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. Criminal's worst nightmare is an honest cop. Traditional saying, sometimes attributed to Frank Serpico, former New York policeman and heroic testifier against corruption. It must be clear to anyone reading this book or listening to these broadcasts that the power of organised crime has grown to frightening levels. It is the world's largest industry. Its illicit profits are above the $1 trillion mark, and it destroys millions of lives a year. Sometimes it is even so secure in its strength that it openly trades in human misery, buying and selling children for a few dollars, or executing opponents without fear of any action from the alleged legitimate authorities. In many countries, it has effectively transformed itself into an alternative form of government, and notorious gangsters worldwide are seen enjoying lives of opulence and luxury. It often seems that organised criminals have it all their own way. However, as the menace of organised crime has grown, so too have the number of dedicated forces and individuals opposed to it. From seminal solo mob busters to government and international agencies, the bravery of certain individuals has been all that has protected society against the rising tide of crime. Just as criminal networks have transformed themselves over recent years, taking advantage of emerging technologies, forming fresh global alliances, and developing innovative ways of making dirty money, so the crime fighters have evolved to tackle the new nature of transnational crime. Yet the core of crime fighting remains ensuring those living in fear of criminal syndicates can believe that justice will prevail and provide protection. When that belief exists and is justified by the actions of the authorities, organised crime is always the loser. Those who fight organised crime professionally complain that police officers are remembered less than the criminals they catch. One of the things I've heard those who fight organised crime professionally complain about over the years is that police officers are remembered less than the criminals they catch. From London to New York, I have heard detectives complain about how the media mythologises the villains instead of lionising the cops. I've even endured rants from one Scotland Yard detective complaining that the most famous detective in England was Sherlock Holmes, a jumped-up fictional character who wouldn't be much good investigating yardie shootings. However, one legendary law enforcement officer who has been mythologised by the media, both at the time of his fight to bring down Al Scarface Capone and his outfit, and in subsequent years, is Elliot Ness. Not that this lionisation pleases some bitter detectives, as Elliot Ness is not an actual policeman, but rather a Treasury agent. When Herbert Hoover became the 31st President of the United States in 1929, his personal grudge against Capone soon became apparent. Hoover wanted Capone behind bars, but it was obvious that Capone had the Chicago and state authorities in his control. Following advice from Colonel Frank Knox, whose paper the Chicago Daily News had started printing a most wanted list, of which Capone was number one, Hoover was determined to nail him on one of two federal charges, bootlegging or tax evasion. To this end, Hoover charged Andrew Mellon, Secretary of the Treasury, with Capone's downfall. Mellon in turn picked 26-year-old graduate Elliot Ness to head up a special unit to bust Capone's bootlegging operations. Ness's first move was to form a squad of agents who would not be susceptible to bribery or blackmail. In addition, he wanted them to be experts in areas he felt would prove invaluable when going up against the bootleggers: wiretapping, sharpshooting, high-speed pursuit, and handling informers. With his team assembled, Ness went to war with the bootlegging side of the Chicago outfit. despite the hype of his later biographers and various films and television shows. Elliot Ness and his mayor never succeeded in making Chicago a dry city. However, their constant raids certainly hit Capone in the pocket. Ness was one of the first lawmen to really understand how to get the full benefit from publicity. Every time he made a major raid, he would tip off the photographers so the papers could get a good picture of his men in action, breaking up a distillery, capturing a truck full of whiskey, or even uncovering a whole warehouse of booze. As soon as one of his men was approached to take a bribe, Ness sold the papers the story of how his men were incorruptible and that the mob had nicknamed them the Untouchables. Ness knew the criminal folklore he is creating would help to convince the public and Capone's own men that Big Al was vulnerable. Within 6 months, Ness claimed to have seized illegal bootlegging assets worth more than $1 million. By 1932, that total had risen to $9 million, with Ness parading captured beer trucks outside Capone's HQ at Chicago's Lexington Hotel in an attempt to humiliate him even further. In the end, Ness and his Untouchables did little more than eat into Capone's profits and cause his operations a load of headaches. Eventually, it was the Internal Revenue Service agent Frank Wilson that made President Hoover a happy man by securing the evidence that finished Capone off. The reality of what Ness achieved in Chicago is somewhat overshadowed by the media myth and legends that sprang up in later years thanks to the autobiography and television show The Untouchables that began airing 2 years after his death in 1957. His even more significant success in cleaning up corruption in Ohio, his failure to catch the Cleveland torso murderer, the threats that were made to his life while he was trying to take down the outfit, and his own drunk driving accident are not included in the films that portray him as an iconic hero and fearless mob buster. Ness was clever, media savvy, and an effective fighter against organized crime. However, his real legacy is as an inspiration, the idea of the incorruptible man who dares to stand up to the power of the mob.
That's Malcolm Greaves reading The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. More on that next week. Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a community internet radio station broadcast on the web at dialectradio.co.uk and at bcfm.org.uk. And BCFM broadcasts us on 93.2 FM across the city of Bristol at 9 PM on a Saturday and 8 PM on Sundays. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, either in reporting or on the engineering side, just come along and sit in and sort of have a feel for how you could contribute or have a look, then get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thank you very much to our studio guest, Iqbal Tamimi. I hope we will have you again in the coming weeks. Reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and studio production was by Mark Condon. The producer was Tony Gosling, 47 years young. Next week we have part three of Mohammed El Haddad and his journey across the Rafah crossing and finally make it into Gaza in Palestine and his reaction upon seeing the sights there. That was Dialect, and this is John Peters Coleman wishing you a very pleasant week. Now that the spring is here and the clocks have all gone forward, we can actually see when it gets to about 7 o'clock. Amazing. From all the team in our Queen's Stair studio in Bristol's Swiddy Centre, thank you for joining us, and take care. Goodbye.